On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Across the country today, American educators are still trying to figure out the full implications of last week's big Supreme Court ruling on race and school assignment. A half century after the court declared that separate but equal does not work in education, the Roberts Court seemed to point straight back to separate but equal, or maybe forward to some new effort at colorblind equality. This is bedrock stuff. Critics are shouting resegregation. Supporters say, so what? Up next on Point, the surprising range of response to the court's big new message on race and schools. We will hear several interesting voices this hour, the first of them from Detroit, where we're joined by Luke Massey. He is national co-chair for the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action. His organization submitted an amicus brief in the Seattle and Louisville court desegregation cases before the Supreme Court. Luke Massey, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, thanks a lot for having me on.
So, Chief Justice John Roberts, writing the majority opinion, says the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. Simple as that. What do you say?
I say it's a fiction, it's hypocrisy, for this judge in striking down these two school desegregation cases to be quoting Brown and to be talking about opposition to discrimination. The fact is, education in America is separate, it's unequal, it remains so. We need desegregation policies in order to attack that, in order to fight that. And in striking these two modest integration programs down, what he's doing is trying to drag the society backward.
53 years since Brown versus Board of Education. That's not long enough?
It is nowhere near long enough. Sadly, the way you can tell that is not by reference to the clock, but by looking at the actual schools that exist in this country. They are separate. They are unequal by race. It is a fact. And the fact is, we need to take that into account, offset the effect of residential segregation by school integration plans. The two programs in question here in Seattle and Louisville were overwhelmingly popular plans with people of all races. In striking down these plans, the Supreme Court has struck at the popular will for integration and equality in this country, and the new civil rights movement is going to be forced to overturn these decisions.
But, you know, we've already got, as you say yourself, a lot of segregation remaining in American schools, even with the old perspective. So how different is this? Do you expect to see more radical resegregation of American schools?
What we've seen over the last period of several years with the attacks on integration plans, with the attacks on affirmative action, is increasing segregation. However, previous to that, for many years, you had seen an increase in integration in the schools. What we need to do is build the mass struggle for integration in this country to stand up for what's obviously right and just, which is that all students in this society have the right to an equal educational opportunity. That cannot be achieved without integration. It's a fact. It has been tried for generations. The separate but equal idea in Plessy v. Ferguson is a lie. It's a lie in service of racism, and it can be nothing else in this society. What we need is integration and equality to give the young minds in this society a chance to develop their talent and intelligence and ability to the fullest. It's a simple thing. It's in the interest of everyone in this society. The Supreme Court is trying to take us backward, and the new movement, the new civil rights movement, must take us forward and reverse this policy.
But what about the situation? I mean, here we have, again, 50 years and more since Brown versus Board of Education, and we'd have a lot of segregation. And even in integrated classrooms, we have a lot of what everybody agrees is substandard education. So maybe we've learned that integration isn't the key to raising educational standards. Has it really worked?
It has been an incredible improvement in the quality of education to get integration. Going back to rank segregation and rank inequality on the basis of race is not a way forward. It's a way backward. For many, many years, we were making slow, inadequate, but real improvement. Now, over the last 10 years, we've been going backwards. What this Supreme Court decision will do is accelerate that backward trend. What we must do now, as people that are for integration, who are for equality between the races, must do is stand up and organize and fight and reverse this decision. What the Supreme Court is trying to do, of course, is what the right wing has wanted since Brown versus Board of Education, which is the substantive overturning of Brown. What we've got to do is reverse that. the progress that has been made has been substantial. It has been substantial. And what we have to do is get back on the road of progress. The only way to do that, though, is by struggle, is by civil rights organizing.
So take it to the street, says Luke Massey in Detroit. Mr. Massey, please stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation, if I may, from Washington, D.C. We're joined by Michael Steele, former Republican Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, African-American Lieutenant Governor. He's currently chairman of the National Republican Political Action Group, GOPAC. He's a partner at the law firm of LaBeouf, Lamb, Green & McCray in Washington. Michael Steele, thanks very much for being here.
It's great to be with you, Tom. How you doing?
We're good, and we're very interested in this decision and how it is likely to play out. You hear the perspective of Luke Massey there saying this is a disaster. It heads us back to the bad old past, and we got to go to the streets with a new civil rights movement to address it. What do you say?
Well, I agree with the concept of going to the streets. I just want to go to the streets for the right reason and say the right things. I mean, I just want to be very clear from the beginning that there's not a conservative that I know or a Republican that I know or a libertarian that I know that wants to go back to pre-Brown versus Board of Education. So I think as we begin this discussion, and I think that the Supreme Court has really started a debate in the country, and what I want to move it to is what it should be about, which I'll get to in a second.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into the hot, you know, rhetoric of, you know, racism here and racism there and finding racism under every rock. The reality of it is we have kids in public school systems that are failing these kids. And I agree with the point that we should take it to the streets. But when we take it to the streets, what are we going to be talking about? We're talking about the education of students. And the bottom line is, for me at least, and for my family and my community, it doesn't matter if I'm in a classroom with white kids. It matters if I'm in a classroom with a good teacher. And so the reality to the point that you were just raising is that since Brown versus Board of Education, we have seen the steady, slow but steady degradation of the public school city, particularly in the urban communities where African Americans and other minorities predominantly live. And when parents decide that they want to put their kids into a program that will teach their children, the government and society should not say to them, well, you can't put your kid in this school because it's not enough white kids in there or there are too many blacks. The reality of it is you need to put their kids in the schools where they can learn. And if we equalize the process, and I will agree with Mr. Massey to this extent, as I interpreted what he said, that if we equalize this process, and where we're going to provide it, get on the ground on the streets and actually force our school system to educate kids so that you don't have such a high disparity between those kids who go to suburban schools and those kids who go to urban schools to those kids that go to schools that are 60% white versus those that go to that are 70% black. Then you begin to, I think, address the essence of what Brown versus Board of Education was about, which was equal access to education.
But let me ask you, you said you don't want to go back. You said the conservatives, you know, don't want to go back. But let's go to a kind of baseline principle here. I mean, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896, saying separate but equal is okay. And I kind of hear you saying that again, separate but equal is okay. I thought Brown versus Board of Education said that doesn't work.
Not at all. Let me be very, I am not saying separate.
You said integration doesn't matter.
What I'm saying is that integration is a part of the process. But if you sit there and you're going to hold up a standard that says, as these two school districts did and said, well, told a parent, you can't have your child go to this school because we have met our quota of white students, and therefore now we're trying to fill the rest out with black, or we've met our quota with black students, and therefore we're trying to fill out the rest of our quota with whites, that is a problem. And that is not giving a child access to good quality education. And the way you begin, in my view, to address that, the whole notion of separate but equal is to make it truly equal. If that's the case, and right now there's a huge disparity, and you've heard in the black community at least conversations about, you know, majority black institutions, whether it's an HBCU or a high school, and the quality of resources, the level of teaching, and the capability that they have, those kids have to access the same academic marketplace as other schools within the same district. And so my argument is, and I think with the Supreme Court, you talked about whether this is a road backwards or a road forward.
Yep.
I think it's more of a course correction. I think what the Supreme Court did was said, look, let's pay close attention to exactly not just the quantity of education, the style of education, but the quality of that education, and making sure that we're not holding up a standard that in its effect ultimately creates a form of reverse discrimination against blacks, whites, or other minorities, because you've met some standard, some arbitrary standard, some number, 55%, 15%, or whatever.
I'll call it arbitrary, but it does go to the separate but equal idea. Luke Massey, what about it? Integration doesn't matter. It's not the main point.
It sounds like an argument straight from the Plessy Court. That's what it sounds like. And the fact is, for generations, this nation has tried separate but equal. And it has failed all the time. Why? Because it was a fiction to begin with. It was a fiction to cover a racist lie.
Let me ask you a question.
And the fact is this: your other guest here, I think is just an apologist for separate but equal.
Michael Steele, let's get the question. Michael Steele, what's the question?
The question is, Mr. Massey. First off, I'm not an apologist for separate but equal. So please don't. Don't even go there. You don't know my history and you don't know my story, so don't go there. Number two, why aren't you then busing white kids out of suburbia into inner-city black schools, majority black high schools and grade schools? If we're so concerned about separate but equal, then the standard would be the other way.
We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's call for colorblind schools and an end to race as the sorting factor in deciding who goes where, looking at the impact of a historic decision. A lot of listeners want to join this conversation. Let me turn to Mary in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hello, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. What do you see?
I'm a teacher in South Carolina, and I've noticed in particular that students and their parents naturally segregate themselves, regardless of what the courts say. I mean, I should know, calling from South Carolina, you might assume that I'm very conservative. I'm actually very liberal. And I worked for a few years in a black district, and now I work in a district that is about 65% white and 35% black. And the students and their parents really do tend to segregate themselves based on what teachers they request, based on what classes they take.
So do you favor the Supreme Court action here, Mary? Are you glad that they said let's take race out of the assignment equation or not?
Honestly, I'm afraid it doesn't have much of an impact. People are getting in this big uproar, and what the concern should be is on national education based on how students, in particular like here in South Carolina, where we're at the bottom of student funding, but we're still trying to make the same progress that students are in other states, such as Connecticut, where they have amazing amounts of funding.
Mary, let us pick that up. Luke, teacher Mary is kind of making Michael Steele's point. She's, you know, they've got segregation anyway, and the real issue is funding. They just don't have enough of it. Maybe, you know, race is the wrong place to focus. People are going to do what people do.
No, I don't think that's true. Obviously, there's a dramatic increase in funding needed in public education. The resources embodied in the young people of this society are our most precious thing, and they are being squandered as of this point. That needs to be changed, yes. However, apologizing for separate and unequal segregated education is not the way to get increased funding for education. We've got to tackle both problems. The fact is that both the Seattle and Louisville plans at question in the Supreme Court case bust students out of their neighborhoods of all races, and they were overwhelmingly popular. In the Louisville case, it was 82% popular with both black and white families. So saying that people segregate themselves, well, in reality, there's overwhelming support for Brown versus Board of Education in this country. There's overwhelming support for integrated and diverse education and the opportunities that only diverse and integrated education gives to people.
Michael Steele, I want to be sure I really understand your perspective and your story. You said that you yourself are kind of an affirmative action baby, that you wouldn't be in your nice law firm without it. So,
absolutely.
But are white-only and black-only classrooms fine by you? Or I want to pin down exactly what you're saying.
Look, at the end of the day, I mean, I agree with the teacher. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, my experience is people are going to go where they want to go. I mean, when I come from the wealthiest black county in the United States, in Prince George's County, its school system, very much like the city I grew up in, Washington, D.C., is like 78-80% African-American. And the question then becomes that because of the way this system is set up, should we then have a plan to move white kids into that system? Because it is too black. just as people would get upset and want to create a plan to move kids into a system that was majority white.
But that's an exceptional district, as you say, the richest in the country.
But this is my point.
Mm-hmm.
That became that way because of the natural migration patterns, the way people moved out of the city into the suburbs. And you're finding that as people move in South Carolina or in Maryland and Connecticut, wherever, as people move, these systems change. The numbers change. The percentages change. And my only point is, let's not hang our hats on just that hook to try to accommodate someone's ideal of what would be perfect integration. I'm there for integration. I believe schools should be, you know, white kids and black kids learning together, kumbaya moment. Great.
Yeah, yeah.
But if the school system itself, if that school does not have math and science teachers in it, if that school system has teachers that are stressed out and are teaching to a test, if that school has books that are 10 years old, and I just described a school in Baltimore City,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
then you are failing the process. It doesn't matter whether you have white kids or black kids. The problem is the kids aren't learning.
But for clarity, you are willing to try separate but equal again, Michael Steele, just to be clear.
I'm not willing to try separate but equal.
Don't turn over the apple cart, you know, just to get integrated schools. The funding is more important.
I'm a strong advocate and proponent of Brown versus Board of Education. I get it. I understand it. I know what it's about. I've lived it. I've experienced it. I grew up in a segregated city. It's called the nation's capital.
Yep.
Okay? So I know what that's all about.
Yep.
My only point is that as we begin to move forward, we can't just get hung up on the fact that there's, you know, it's 55% white and mm-hmm. 45% black. What I'm also looking at is beyond the color in the classroom to the quality of education in that classroom. What I'm finding is that where most of my kids, black kids, are going to school, whether it's integrated or not, if it's majority black, generally that school is having a difficult time on resources, teachers,
that's right,
et cetera.
In other words, the two things are related.
Well.
Yeah, Luke?
In other words, the two things are related. The fact of segregation is related to the fact that you're talking about overstressed, overworked teachers, 10-year-old books. Look at racially segregated schools. Look at overwhelmingly Latino and black schools. They very disproportionately have the overstressed 10-year-old books, the overstressed teachers, 10-year-old books, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
You describe natural migration patterns. Oh, come on. It's not natural migration patterns at all. It's systematic discrimination in housing loans. It's systematic discrimination in the real estate business.
What the heck are you talking about, man?
This is not natural migration patterns.
It is a natural migration. I watched my county, Prince George's County, go from majority white in the 1970s to majority black in the 1980s and 90s.
And well-off black.
Where do you think those black folks came from? They didn't grow up out of the field. They came out of the cities.
Mm-hmm.
They moved to the suburbs. Mm-hmm.
And you don't think that they're steering in real estate?
Michael Steele
and
Luke Massey, please stand by. I want to invite our listeners in again. Christine's calling from Barrington, Rhode Island. Christine, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you, Tom.
Yep.
I wanted to say that if this were an issue about affordable housing, the Supreme Court ruling seems to me to be saying, but you can't take how much money people have into account. And basically, the government, ever since the censuses started in 1790, were designating people by race. And I kind of calculated 1790 up through as late as I know censuses to reveal what races they designate as 1930. That's 140 years of people being defined by their race.
So you're saying race is still behind everything to you? What about Michael Steele, who says, look, it's not the only issue here?
Oh, I know it's not the only issue, but what I'm basically saying is, finally, with Brown versus Board of Education, mm-hmm. race was the issue that was going to be on the side of the people who had been discriminated against by their race. So finally, after 140 years of race being used against them, they've only had 50 years of race being able to be used on behalf of that group of people.
Sounds like you're saying too soon to let that go.
Yeah, and actually, ironically enough, listening to the rest of this conversation, my grandmother's brother helped to write a Maryland law in 1916. I've read him talking about it. He was a black man, and he, in the middle of Jim Crow, is writing that he just got a new Maryland Board of Education law passed that would bring things almost to an equal place. And to me, it's very heartbreaking because back then, there was still many, many years before Brown versus Board of Education was to happen. I think he would be heartbroken by this situation, and I just would love to hear a debate between him posthumously and Mr. Steele. Because
we can arrange a lot of things. That one is difficult, but we will get a debate. And Christine, thanks for your call. I want to go to Santa Monica, California right now, and Gary Orfield, he's a longtime advocate of desegregation, professor of education now at UCLA. He's also co-director of UCLA's Civil Rights Project. Gary Orfield, thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
What do you make of the Supreme Court's decision here and its likely impact on American children's education?
Well, first of all, we should sort out what the decision actually is. The decision by what's called the plurality, the four justices that agreed with the opinion of the Chief Justice, really was a striking limitation of Brown versus Board of Education. It really said almost nothing could be done consciously except when you're under a court order to deal with the problem of segregation. The opinion of the dissent by four justices led by Justice Breyer really said that these decisions and plans in Louisville and Seattle were extremely modest, effective, and that local control of schools ought to be honored by the conservatives, and they ought to let people have a voluntary desegregation plan, especially when it was very popular, supported by the electorates, and it worked.
Yep.
Now, in the middle was Justice Kennedy from California, and he said integration is a very important goal, but most of the means that we use to achieve it outside of court orders are illegal, and that we should try something else, which was not very well spelled out. And I think school districts are going to be struggling in the middle of this for a long time, trying to figure out. It's a lot like the affirmative action case of Bakke in 1978, where there were four justices on one side, four on another. And in the middle was Justice Lewis Powell.
But the simple race filter seems to be not on the table, and that's a big step in itself, isn't it? Take us out of the courtroom for a second. I mean, we've had 50 years plus of Brown versus Board of Education. You know, is it time we can say, well, that didn't work, even if it integrated schoolrooms? Let's try something else. I mean, do you see this as a step forward or backward?
It's important to know what really went on under Brown versus Board of Education. For the first 10 years, almost nothing went on.
Right.
98% of blacks remained in segregated schools because almost every state resisted this with all of its might in the South. What happened in Brown versus Board of Education is that this effort was defined by the court about what it would mean, which would be to require root and branch desegregation, only in 1968. Only during the period from the middle 60s to the early 70s was there sustained enforcement of Brown versus Board of Education, and that was mostly in the South. In that period, the South went from complete apartheid to being the most integrated part of the country. When we came into the North, the Supreme Court, by 5-4, blocked including suburbs in the desegregation process, and that, as Thurgood Marshall predicted, meant that the North would never really desegregate. We also had a decision which I think undermines the argument of the separate but equal folks in 1973 by the same Supreme Court, 5-4, that said there is no federal right to equal education. So you've got Plessy undermined because there's no federal right to equal education. You've got Brown undermined by a series of Supreme Court decisions that began in the early 1990s that said we'll begin to drop mandatory integration. This decision says you can't do the kind of voluntary integration that thousands of magnet schools and so forth have been trying to do.
Right.
You have to find something else. And what the something else is a very, very important question.
But let me ask you what looks like the basic question here is, do you think this will lead to more segregated classrooms, and does that matter?
This will lead to more segregated classrooms. How much that happens depends on whether or not school boards invest the resources to have a multiple-dimensional integration plan like colleges have. Yes, it matters a lot. In segregated schools and classrooms, there are every form of inequality, and it's not just money. It's the level of competition. It's the quality of the teachers, the experience of the teachers. The graduation rates are lower for children with the same ability in segregated schools. The college-going rates are lower. The success in college is lower. Now, this integration and desegregation aren't the only thing we need to worry about, but they're pretty powerful things. They wouldn't be if they weren't linked to so many other things. But efforts to equalize just accepting segregation, which is what we've basically been doing since the Reagan era, haven't worked. We had a plan called Goals 2000 to equalize achievement by 2000. By the time 2000 came, they weren't even publishing the statistics because no progress had been made in the previous 12 years.
Right.
We now have one called No Child Left Behind, and no progress is being made on the racial achievement gap under that plan.
Hold that thought, if you would. I want to get a call from Buffalo, New York. Wilfried, you're on the air, sir.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a question and then a comment.
Yeah.
The question is to your speakers, and it is, do they really think that by sitting next to a white person, a black person is going to get smarter or learn more? Okay. And my point is the following, okay? My point is that good learning or good teaching has to do with resources and teachers, okay? So instead of spending a lot of effort trying to integrate the schools, we need to spend this effort trying to put good teachers and good resources in every school. So that it doesn't matter even if the school is 100% black, if I have the resources, I can learn.
Wilfried, let us pick that up. Michael Steele, is that your point?
That was my point. The gentleman was just speaking before the caller.
Gary Orfield,
yeah,
at UCLA.
Yeah. Making very much of the same points I was trying to make in terms of how this process has kind of unfolded, which has gotten us to where we are, and the caller has just now put the period on it. And that's really what I'm saying. I mean, if you're saying to me that I need to integrate my child and put my child in a classroom with white kids in order for him to learn, I'm offended by that. Because what I need my child to have is a good teacher. And if that school, whether it's an all-black school or an all-Hispanic school, has good quality teachers, good resources, and everything that all the white kids have, my kids are going to learn. But if you're saying to me that the only way a black child is going to learn is that I put him in a classroom and sit him next to a white kid, that to me is racist.
But wasn't the argument that your child is not likely to get the resources to learn if he's not next to a white kid because of racism?
And that's the core point, and that's what the school boards need to start addressing. When I did a study of our school system for 2 years, my last 2 years in office, we sat down and I talked to over 1,000 teachers, over 1,000 principals, and they will tell you that the disparity in education has less to do with race and more to do with the resources. That's what the teacher who called from South Carolina was trying to say as well, is that the school boards and the superintendents and the state of operations really sit down and look at where the poor kids are learning and where the rich kids are learning, where the black kids are learning and where the white kids are learning, you'll see that that gap is caused more by a lack of resources than any integration plan or lack thereof.
Michael Steele, Luke Massey, thanks very much for being with us today. We're talking this hour about the Supreme Court's call last week for colorblind schools and an end to race. We've been joined by Gary Orfield, professor of education at UCLA. He's been following these issues for a long, long time. We're joined as well right now, and happy to be so, by Lonnie Guinier, professor of law at Harvard University, author of the forthcoming book, Meritocracy, Inc. She first came to public attention in 1993 when President Clinton nominated her to be the first black woman to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. Clinton withdrew her nomination after a storm of protest from conservatives who labeled her a quota queen, a label she has always rejected. She's following these issues very closely right now. Lonnie Guinier, it's great to have you. Thank you for being here. What do you see in this decision?
I actually agree with most everything that's been said by everyone.
That's hard to do, I think.
Except with regard to one thing that Michael Steele said. So I do think that the decision, particularly the Roberts opinion, is a cruel irony because it misreads the role that race has played in our history. This is not a question simply of classifying people by race. It is a question of having a history of an inferior and a superior race. Mm. And that's what Plessy basically said was okay. That's what Brown overruled. And now Roberts is coming in and trying to reinterpret this history. It's not just he's not just reinterpreting a decision.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, however, I agree that we need a course correction because I don't think that the issue is purely one of racial integration. Race has been used as a way of masking class inequalities, and so I disagree completely with the idea that race is irrelevant. But I do think that we have to begin to link race and class much more directly, and to begin, again, like Luke Massey said, have a popular mobilization, but it should be around urban-rural coalitions. It should be around bringing more resources into our schools, and it has to be a way of doing so consistent with, I agree here with Gary Orfield, Justice Kennedy's important contribution to this discussion, by looking at the issue through a different lens. But we can't put race aside. Race is a very, very important diagnostic tool here, and it is an historic definition of our society.
But this course correction, as Michael Steele unfolded it, it seemed essentially he's saying, let's put quality of education before everything else. And now, is that a step forward or a step back
I think you have to take into account what Gary Orfield is saying, that you can't just talk about quality education when the Supreme Court has also said that there's no federal right to quality education. So, basically, we need to fix what the Supreme Court has gotten wrong in many of its cases. This is just one of many cases in which the Supreme Court has gotten things wrong. And I don't think we should take our lead from the Supreme Court. I think that's where Luke Massey is right. We've got to have people, and especially poor black people and poor white people, joining hands and demanding the United States give everyone a quality education.
So there's a new dynamic maybe in the offing. Let's go to Kyle in Boston. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I also am very intrigued by all of the points, and per Michael Steele's point, the question I had, or the comment that I had, was around how do we fund that quality that he wants? And it strikes me that one of the challenges is there's got to be a certain amount of redistribution of resources involved in this. And as I look, just anecdotally, the further people are away from the place their money's going to, the less likely they are to support it. So if we don't somehow have integration be part of it, we're going to rely on folks who have resources somewhere, sending their resources to folks who don't. And unfortunately, I'm not just terribly optimistic about that being a very powerful mechanism for getting this done.
Well, we know that local property taxes pay so much of the school bills already. Kyle, it's a good point. Gary, what do you say?
Yeah, well, I think that this is a really important point. You know, the schools that blacks and Latinos are segregated in have a lot of poverty, and so do the communities. And for Latinos, who are even larger group than blacks now and more segregated, a lot of them don't yet have voting rights, or they're too young, or they're still in immigrant status. So they don't have much political power, and making more money flow to the most powerless groups is like making water flow uphill. It just doesn't happen. There's never enough money to do everything you want in schools, and the schools that are advantaged always come out ahead because they have the most power in the elections for school boards and for state governments and so forth. But I'd like to say, let's deconstruct the idea of quality a little.
Yeah, okay.
We did a study of all the schools in metropolitan Atlanta, and we found in a whole decade when the central city had more money than any of the suburbs, we found that there was almost no relationship between the number of dollars and the outcomes, the graduation rates or the test scores. And that's because money isn't the right way to think about quality. What makes a quality school is the teachers, the other students, the parents who are involved, the curriculum, the reputation, the connections. It happens that all of those things are related to race. If blacks were middle class and more affluent and whites were poor, it would be a big advantage for whites to get into a black school. People have to understand how these things play out. We have 85% white teachers in this country. They move very systematically out of disadvantaged, high poverty, minority schools as their careers progress. We know teachers don't really contribute a lot to students until they have 2 or 3 years of experience. Teachers that go into these schools are the most inexperienced, and they're very ill prepared to deal with what they encounter across race and class lines. These things are all related in a very systematic way, and if we think that we can break this just by transferring money, and if we think that the suburban schools and so forth are going to transfer a lot of money to high poverty schools, You don't understand. Plessy versus Ferguson is the largest social experiment in American history. We tried it in thousands of districts for most of a century. It never produced equal schools anywhere, as far as I can tell.
And yet, we've had Brown versus Board of Education. We hardly have heaven on earth yet. Lonnie Guinier, I want to get you on that.
Let me
get
a couple. We hardly had any enforcement of Brown versus Board of Education except during the Johnson administration, early 70s.
I agree that it's not simply a question of money, but I want to just read something that Martin Luther King Jr. said in 1959. He said he favored integration on buses and in all areas of public accommodation and travel. He's all for equality. However, and this is a quote, I think integration in our public schools is different. In that setting, you are dealing with one of the most important assets of an individual, the mind. White people view black people as inferior. A large percentage of them have a very low opinion of our race. People with such a low view of the black race cannot be given free rein and put in charge of the intellectual care and development of our boys and girls. Now, this is the point that Wilfred was making from Buffalo. This is partly the point that Michael Steele was making. I think we have to take that into account. I'm not suggesting that money is the solution, but I also don't think that pure integration is the solution either.
Because in that integrated setting, maybe under a white school board, you're suggesting black kids won't get the attention, care, respect they deserve. Well, you want a black environment for black education, for example?
No, I'm not saying. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that even within an integrated school, you have segregation because the black kids are often tracked into the special education classes. The teachers often have low expectations of their capacity, and we have to address that as well. And the conversation just about racial integration misses that fundamental aspect.
But what are you pointing to then, Lonnie Guinier, as a way out of that trap?
I'm suggesting that we have to focus on quality education in a way that is not simply about money, that understands the dynamic of race, and that also understands that poor white kids in rural America are also being shortchanged, so that this is not just about race, it's not just about class, but it's about what I would call race class. It's about both. And you can't, the problem with the Supreme Court opinion is it wants to drop race out of the conversation. That's wrong. But the problem with those who focus simply on integration are dropping class and the history of race out of the conversation.
So you're kind of in there with Justice Anthony Kennedy, maybe, Lonnie Guinier. You want race diminished as a factor, but not kicked out.
Well, I'm not with Anthony Kennedy because he, I think, is going too far in terms of forbidding the classification or the consideration of race in certain circumstances. But I do agree with him that integration is a virtue. It is a goal. I agree with that, but I also agree with Justice Stevens that we have a history of inferior and superior races. It's not simply racial classification that's the problem. It's a problem of hierarchy. It's a problem of dominance, and we have to address that even within a paradigm that's talking about integration.
Gary Orfield, there's a kind of fuzziness around this that I'm finding it hard to break through. I mean, everyone's thinking clearly in their own stripe. Maybe it's just me. Is there a different way to thread this needle then than we've done it for the last 50 years? If it's not going to be, you know, race as the first sort of sorting factor, is there an alternate way?
Yes, I think.
I think he was asking me.
I'll ask you both, but Gary, if you don't mind first.
Yeah,
Gary.
Yes. What I would say is, I'd have to agree with Professor Guinier completely that you can't, just getting students into buildings that are interracial is inadequate. We've known that since the 1960s. What happens inside the building is all tremendously important, and it's getting from desegregation to integration, which Dr. King defined as a really change of heart, a change of how you view people, mutual respect, equal treatment, so forth. Those are the conditions under which integration is successful. And those are the conditions that we actually found when we surveyed the students in Louisville, for example, not for this case, before this case. We found that 85-90% of the black students and white students agreed on all kinds of things about their relationships, about what they learned, about how they understood each other, about how they had a richer understanding of American history, how they felt prepared to live and work together as adults. You know, it's not easy to do, but I'll tell you, segregation and equality have proved to be impossible on any significant scale in American history. Now, we need to think about what we've learned from these experiences, and we need to think about what works. And we need to look at the fact we've been going backwards towards resegregation for 16 years already, and for Latinos for over a third of a century. And we've tried all kinds of alternatives. There's a vastly larger investment in separate but equal policies like No Child Left Behind, like Title I, like other things, than there ever has been in desegregation. And desegregation's only part. Desegregation's the first step towards integration. And there's a lot of schools that can't be desegregated and where we have to try to equalize them. But it's very hard, and the politics of it have proved to be impossible to do on a large scale so far. And that's why when you think about what the Supreme Court said in 1954, that this is inherently unequal. It's not because there's anything wrong with black people or Indian people or Latino people. It's because there's something wrong with our society and that we've systematically failed to make separate equal in any meaningful way. Ever.
I want to take a couple quick calls and get to you, Professor Guinier. Ellie's calling from Bluffton, South Carolina. Ellie, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
With all due respect, the first and most important parent or teacher is the parent. I think the whole focus should be on parental input in their child's lives. The children should be nourished. They should be disciplined. They should be taught to respect themselves and authority. There should be a desire to be educated, not mock kids that get good grades. And the parents are in charge of making sure their children attend and behave.
Ellie, our
and
time is short, but I think everybody will hear where you're coming from there. Let me get one more, and then we'll go to Lonnie. James is calling from Boston. James, you're on the air.
It's a pleasure to hear this conversation. I appreciate the comments about money and resources because it's a big part of it. But not the only part, as noted by Washington D.C. is the well-funded, most well-funded per capita district, but the lowest performing. The other argument for integration, or the other argument for integration, which I'm not against, and I'm not for segregation, but is the social development of the children. And you look, if that's the case, maybe the callers can comment briefly on. Why don't we ship the kindergartners from South Carolina to Boston so that they can understand North and South, or have kids, shipped from, here to China so that we can understand the Chinese when we get into the workplace?
James, our time is short, but we hear that as well. No big fan of busing kids around right there. Lonnie Guinier, there's 2 points. Number one, it's the parents first. How do you respond to that? And number two, James sounds happy to be done with busing if that's where we're going.
So the parents need to be part of our commitment to educating everyone. That is, everyone should be a lifelong learner. This is not just about educating children. It's also about making sure that parents who grew up in a segregated and unequal environment also have opportunities that were denied them in the course of their life. This is not about busing children. It's really about redistributing resources that include good teachers, that include lifelong learning, that really go about over. If we're going to overturn or try to have a course correction, it's San Antonio versus Rodriguez, the 1973 case that Gary Orfield mentioned, that says we have a federal right to an equal education, and we need to change the way we fund education so that you can't encourage what Michael Steele called the natural migration of people to the suburbs. But you can move to the suburbs, but you're still going to have to pay for the education of people in the inner cities as well as in rural America.
But interestingly, I hear you in some degree welcoming, tell me if I'm wrong, a move beyond the Brown versus Board of Education era. Am I wrong?
Yes. No, I think we have to move beyond the Brown versus Board of Education era because we've gotten hung up in a view of race that is inadequate to address the problems of race.
Gary Orfield, do you see a new consensus or direction emerging that's going to solve the problems we all see on the table then, or are we just in a fog here?
Well, I think that we are in a very negative period when there is no prospect of major resources, and there's no prospect of major redistribution of teachers, and we have fewer tools available. And I think school districts and educational leaders around the country have to think about what they can best do under this decision, and I think there are some ways to preserve some possibilities, but I think we also have to mobilize to get serious resources to help our poor kids in general and their families. because we really haven't addressed the underlying reality that creates unequal schools now for a couple of generations. Mm-hmm. And we have that's what's underneath this entire thing.
And I agree.
Yep, we got it. Step by step in a new day. Fascinating. Lonnie Guinier, professor of law at Harvard Law School, great to have you with us. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And Gary Orfield, professor of education at UCLA. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.